Hello, Joshua Boswell here with Copywriter Marketer. This is a video newsletter series. Today we're going to talk about how to create rapport in print. We're going to talk specifically about this writing skill, this ability to create rapport in print. We're going to talk about three specific questions. What is rapport? Why do you want it? Why is this important to have and to create? And how do you get it? How do you get this thing that we call rapport and put it to use? So first, let's talk about what rapport is. And I think this can best be described through this experience that we have all had. Not long ago, I got a phone call. I was driving down the road and my phone rang. I reached over and I looked at, kind of glanced down at it, tried to keep my hand on the wheel, eyes forward, glanced down at it. And it said, Dream Girl. So I hit the button and I came up on my car phone speakers. Hey, Margie, how are you? It didn't even ring hardly twice before I answered. Well, not long ago, a few hours later, driving down the road still again, my phone rings. I glance down at it, look at who it is, and it's got this Florida number. A Florida number. Now, over the past few weeks, I've been getting this phone call from all different parts of the country telling me that I've been named in a lawsuit and I should call immediately and provide payments for the settlement. Well, I mean, clearly a scam. And so my response, of course, is, you know, reject call and add that to yet another long string of banned numbers in my life. Now, the first caller, my dear wife, the official dream girl, the first caller has a massive amount of rapport in my life, right? The second caller, a telemarketer, scam artist, whoever they are, I don't know who they are, you know, has zero negative, way over here, vast negative rapport in my life. I don't want to deal with them. I don't want to talk to them. Nothing about it. Now, that is rapport. Rapport is when you are in a state where you have weight in somebody's life. And that weight causes you to be able to have connection with them. That's rapport. And they become compliant. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. So what is rapport? Rapport broken down very succinctly is, number one, when you are similar to somebody else. When you first go up and meet somebody, you shake their hand, say, hey, Bob, how you doing? Nice to meet you. And then what do we immediately start doing? We start a conversation with them. Hey, where are you from? What kind of work do you do? You know, how did you get involved in that work, etc.? What are we doing? When we start asking those kind of questions, what are we doing? I'll tell you exactly what we're doing. We're trying to find similarities. We're trying to find connective tissue that would start to create a relationship. That expression, that opposites attract, is phooey. At least in human beings, it's phooey. Now, yes, are there things that we admire about other people that are different than what we have? Yes, and I'm going to come to that point in just a second. But the first and strongest connectivity tissue that we have with other human beings is similarities. And similarities create rapport. The second thing is we like somebody. When we like them, we have rapport with them. So when we like people, we usually like them because they feel a need in our life. They help us to feel special. They help us to feel unique. They help us to feel like we're loved. And when we feel that way, when somebody else makes us feel that way, then we feel connected to them. And so we give them a portion of our rapport. We have this draw to them. The third way, the third thing that what is rapport is when you see somebody that has a certain level of skills or ability or social standing or physique or financial standing or whatever it is, when you see that in somebody else and you want that, you want to be similar to them because you see that what they have looks like it's making them happy, making them feel loved, making them feel special and unique. And when you see that that's the result of these things that they have in their life, you want to be like them. You want to be similar to them. And so you give them a portion of your rapport, hoping that in doing so, they will kind of lead you along, or some of their greatness will rub off on you, or some of their status, or some of their income, or whatever it is, some of their abilities will rub off on you. You can become like them, similar, and then you can have that same experience of feeling loved and feeling special and feeling unique and being different, all those kinds of great things that we seek for as human beings. Now, okay, why do you want rapport? I think this is very, very simply stated in this simple word called compliance. That's why you want rapport, is because rapport brings compliance. Go back to my simple example of Margie calling me. When Margie calls, I comply by answering. I take action that she desires. She calls because she wants to talk to me, so I answer the phone and I respond to that. She has rapport with me, therefore I comply with her wishes and her desires. I'll give you a great example is Margie is about to go in for foot surgery. She's already had foot surgery on her right foot and she's about to go into foot surgery for her left foot. She has really bad flat feet, and this is a corrective surgery. It's planned. It's not an urgent catastrophe or anything like that. It's just the way it is. Well, there was some complications with our insurance, the deductible, the billing. Like, we're getting multiple billing statements of stuff that we had already paid, and then there was this whole situation with the time that the surgery was going to get on. Like, there's this whole stack of bureaucratic red tape going on there with this surgery. And we wanted it all to go away. So Margie calls up and she got one of the admittance people on the phone that we had talked to last time we were in there and had developed some rapport with. This was a young mother and she was amazed at Margie's ability to be so calm, cool, and collected and have 11 children and manage all of it in the household. And she could clearly see that I was a handful and Margie just gracefully handled me. So this woman thought a high amount of respect for Margie. She wanted to be like her. Therefore, there was this level of rapport. So Margie called up and said, hey, you know, I've got this problem with the insurance and there's this thing and there's the other thing. And this gal says to her, oh, you know what? I probably should talk to my supervisor before I do this, but let me just change up some things really quick in the computer for you. And so, you know, click, 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 as she types away, ticks her on her stuff, and boom, all the problems magically melt away. The times got changed, the insurance got resolved, you know, the procedure got, like, all the things that we were dealing with, the bureaucratic red tape of this hospital system, all magically, poof, went away. Now, that gal complied with Margie's requests. Why did she do that? Because they had rapport. Now, you as a persuasive writer, whether you're writing blog posts or content on a website or sales letters or whatever it is that you're writing, you need to create rapport with the reader so that they will comply, so that they'll think the thoughts that you're suggesting they think, so that they'll take action in a way you're suggesting them to take action. In other words, they'll buy something or click on something or sign up for something or go to another page or refer somebody or whatever it is that's going on there, you want them to comply with your request. That's why you have rapport, okay? Now, let's talk for just a few minutes about how you create rapport, okay? How do you create rapport? Well, the number one way, by far, the best way to create rapport is in a live person-to-person setting. Now, why is that? Well, one of the reasons is because in a live person-to-person setting, you can read the nonverbals. See, we tend to create rapport, determine if we're going to grant rapport on two different levels, verbal and nonverbal. So when you're with somebody, you can see what their facial expressions are like. You can hear what the intonation is in their voice. You can see their body posture. You can read them. You can smell them. You can hear them. You can touch them. And you can develop rapport very rapidly because you're triggering all the different senses and you're creating this similarity or this connectivity through them liking you, you liking them, or you're showing them that they should be like you or they want to be similar. You're invoking that desire inside of them. And so in a live setting, it's really, I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's a lot easier. And so that's the number one way to create rapport, is to get live face-to-face with people. But guess what? We're writers. So if rapport is developed through these five senses that we have and is invoked through the verbal and nonverbal communication, then how do we do that as writers? And how do we create instant rapport with somebody as a writer so that we can gain compliance and so that they will take the action that we want them to take, whether it's to feel a certain way, to think a certain way, buy a certain thing, whatever that is. Well, if the number one thing is this, then the number two way, and this is a great secret that I want to share with you that I hope you'll put into practice, because not very many people talk about this, but really this is the fundamental bottom line. How do you create that rapport in writing? You invoke imagination. Now let me explain that. Imagination is a powerful thing. In fact, it has been proven multiple times that the brain, and specifically the conscious and the subconscious part of your mind, cannot distinguish between imagined and reality. That's why when we sit down and watch a 3D movie and they take you on one of those wild roller coaster style rides where you're coming up to the edge, you know, click, 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 and all of a sudden the train, you know, the mining cart or the car or, you know, like Polar Express. If you've seen Polar Express, they take the train down to the gulch and they got a strap on right to the front grill and you're like coming up over the edge and all of a sudden, and then you plow down the hill. Well, when you watch that, particularly in 3D, it's an imagination. It's just a thought. It's just pictures. But what does your stomach do when you watch that? Well, if you're like me, what happens is your whole gut goes right up in your throat, just like you're on the roller coaster. Well, why is that? Because your mind does not distinguish between imagined and reality. This is why serious athletes and actors and, you know, people that are involved with high performance stuff, that's why they go over this in their mind again and again and again. They rehearse their scripts. They practice out the details. I heard a study that Michael Jackson used to go and he would perform his performances, his music videos over and over and over and over and over in his mind, in his imagination. He would get it perfect. And then he would go out and physically invoke it to create muscle memory, physical muscle memory. But a lot of it was already there because he had imagined it, right? Because he had imagined it. I remember years ago when I was a teenager and my sister recommended to me, she walked in one day and she had this huge thick book. She walked in one day and she says, this is an amazing book. I really think you should read that. She hands it to me. I take this book. And it's like it's heavy. What is this book? And I read on the cover, Les Miserables. And so I'm like, Les Miserables, and I heard the music, and here's the book. And so, so I sit down, and I start reading it, and I'm pulled in, I'm enthralled right away. It just fascinated me. I don't know why, but like all of a sudden, I found myself like grappling and trying to escape from the boat, like I was Jean Valjean, and being there when he gets caught and thrown back into prison and standing there, you know, raising my fist in anger and frustration at the Thénardiers for the brutal way that they treated Cosette. And then, you know, being the hero of the story with Valjean as we come in and rescue Cosette and carry her off. And then I remember, you know, so for days on end, I'm sitting there reading this book. It's like 1,200 pages. I'm not that fast of a reader. And I remember coming to the end, sitting on my bed, just crying like a baby. Just watch the final scenes of Jean Valjean's heroic, majestic, amazing life unfold as he selflessly steps away. I think foolishly, but selflessly steps away from the wedding of Cosette and Marius and gives up himself so that they can have joy and happiness. I remember just sitting there, bawling my eyes out and tissues and crying and like I'm there. I'm experiencing this. I'm complete physicality is wrapped up and enrolled in reading this book. Now, it's interesting, on a side note, years later, I walked into my daughter, Esther. I walked into her room one day, and there's Esther with Les Miserables in her hands and with a bunch of used tissues there. And she's right toward the end, and she's got a box of tissues and stuff all around her. And she's crying like, Dad, why did he have that? And so we cried together. It was great. Well, all this, Victor Hugo invoked all of this through a book, through words. He created inside of our imagination physicality. We physically experience all these scenes from this book because of the way that it was portrayed. And you know what? It created rapport. I read that book and I wanted to be like Valjean. I wanted to be heroic. I wanted to be selfless. I wanted to be godly. I wanted to be compassionate. I wanted to be merciful. I wanted all those things because I had rapport with this character. Well, you can do the same thing in print. And I want to give you five different ways to do this, kind of peel the curtain back and share with you some of the insights that allow this kind of deep emotional resonance and attachment to happen. Because when that happens, you create compliance, right? You create a rapport which leads to compliance. So let's talk for just a minute about these five things that you can do to create that rapport in print. So the first one is you use their language, the reader's language. So you step into their mind, you find the conversation that's going on in their mind, you look at not just the words they're using, but the language, the way that they're using those words, and you step right into the conversation and you pick up and you carry on with their language. So now the difference between their language and their words is best described like this. I speak English, but so do some of my friends in Great Britain, right? They live in London. They speak English. I speak English, but do we speak the same language? No, we don't. Sure, we can understand each other, but deep connected, that deep connection happens when, and I'm probably going to get this wrong, but like when my British friends say garage and I say garage, we're using the same word, but we're talking different language. It means the same thing, but we express it differently. And so you've got to be able to understand what's going on inside somebody's mind and what the nuances are of what it means. And you've got to be able to use that language. Now, how do you do that? The only way that I know how to do that is to really step into their world and to become part of that world for a little while. Years ago, I had an opportunity to write for a company called AutoTap. And they make this little computer that plugs into your car, and then it gives you readout of what kind of gas mileage you're using, what are the error codes, how your system's firing and cylinders and all this kind of stuff. And it tells you all about your engine. Well, the main buyer of this are geeked out, people who love cars, classic cars that they've added computer chips to, or newer cars that they're trying to, juice up and pimp out. And so like I started going to car clubs and I started reading their stuff. I submerged myself. I just planted myself in their world for a while. And I listened to the way they talked about stuff. Like, this phrase, they pimped out their car. It sounds kind of like, ugh, gross. But what they mean is that they, add all this stuff to it to make it look cooler and sexier and hotter and to make it look faster and sometimes to make it actually faster and to make it do cool tricks. They're pimping out their cars. Well, I never used that expression in my whole life. But when I wrote the copy for AutoTap, I spoke their language. I talked to them. We talked about what that meant. And it sold very, very well because I was speaking their language. The second thing is intonation. The intonation. So in print, you can intonate. Like, well, first of all, let's give you an example of intonation. Okay, so to do this, I'm going to read you something, and then I'm going to play you a short, tiny little audio clip of someone else reading. And I want you to notice the difference in intonation. So someone that I admire and respect is a gal named Marianne Williamson, and she wrote something that's become wildly popular among a lot of people. And that's this thing called our deepest fear. And so I'm going to read the first sentence from that quote. I won't read the whole thing. It's a marvelous quote. You should read the whole thing if you haven't. Marianne Williamson. She says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. Okay, so that's my rendition. Same words, that's my rendition. So now I want to play for you Marianne Williamson herself reading this. Now I'm just going to stick this up to the microphone so that you can hear it. She did this little meditative thing where she's reading this quote, her own quote, and she's reading it. Now listen to the way that she intonates this quote.
Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure.
Okay, so what you can see there is this, the different influx of the voice. You know, my voice tends to be very hyped up and animated and, you know, and Marianne Williamson was like calm and centered and relaxed, right? So we see these differences in intonation. Now, it's sort of a head scratch, like, well, how do you talk different intonation in copy? How do you do that in writing? Well, what you do is you use bad grammar and indentations and bolds and underlines, and you do things so that when, and you know, the dot, dot, dot stuff, like when you write this out, so you might, I mean, it's written that our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate, no punctuation at all. But if you wrote this out and you wanted to emphasize it a certain way, you might say something like, our deepest fear is not dot, 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 paragraph break, indent, that we are inadequate, period, new paragraph, but dot, 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 paragraph break, indent, that we are powerful beyond measure. And then beyond and measure could be underlined and italicized and bolded, right? So you see that inside, and then when someone's reading that, they mentally know where to put the emphasis. Versus if you just wrote the sentence out, those two sentences out, then they would read it and then they would have to pull in the intonations from their own head, and that may or may not resonate with them. Like if they weren't familiar with it and had read it before, then maybe they wouldn't put emphasis on it. They would just read it. But you can add that intonation. You can add that emphasis by the way that you structure your sentences. And sometimes this requires really bad grammar. And sometimes it requires formatting that drives editors bonkers. But it's okay, because when they read it, you're connecting rapport. You're connecting with them through the intonations that they would use, and not just the words and not just the language, but the intonations that they would use, okay? The third thing is you want to use similar emotionally charged expressions. Again, this requires you to sort of be an insider and to know what's going on inside their head and then what those words mean to them. So as a very silly example, I was thinking of when I was a kid. I used to love watching. I grew up in, you know, I was a kid in the mid 80s, in the early 80s. And I loved watching cartoons. I'm not going to say that's a good thing. Our children don't watch a lot of cartoons these days, but of course they don't watch any. But when I was a kid, I watched a lot of TV and I watched a lot of cartoons. And so, for example, one of the cartoons that I loved was Thundercats. And if you have ever seen Thundercats, like, you know, that starts off with this red streak streaking across the sky through the universe and coming down and looping around the earth and coming up and hitting the middle of Lion-O's massive major sword with the big red cat eye in it. And then he says, thunder, and he strikes his sword. It's thunder, and he strikes his sword. And then he holds it out and he goes, Thundercats, ho! And then the big red blur goes out and the red eye shines up in things, and all the other Thundercats stop and they turn in their magical powers and they come to save Lion-O, and the rest of the cats are all happy, right? So when I say, you know, thunder, thunder, Thundercat, so if you were a Thundercat junkie like I was when I was a kid, then when you hear those words, it gets you emotionally charged. It's this expression, this little expression that revs you up because it makes you feel powerful and courageous and fearless and invincible, like Lino was, right? You're like there with the other Thundercats saving the world. You know, same thing we could talk about G.I. Joe, you know, a real American hero. G.I. Joe is there. He's there. Well, so when we hear these expressions and we use expressions, you know, they say that you should not use trite expressions. And I agree with that. But I also think that you should use expressions that are emotionally charged for people and in a way that, you know, that they respond to. And so it's being able to reach in there and to make connections with them that nobody else would know except for a real insider. And that develops rapport. They see, oh my goodness, this person's like me. And they connect with me. Remember, the number one connectivity tissue is similarity, right? That's the number one connectivity tissue. And so you'll notice that these first, using their language, the intonations, similar expressions, these things show similarities, okay? Now let's show how to invoke some of these other things. Number four in my suggested list here is very intimate personal stories. Bo Eason, one of my mentors in terms of speaking and presenting and talking and storytelling, repeatedly teaches that the more intimate and personal a story is, the more universal it becomes. Why? Because when we tell intimate, personal stories, we open ourselves, we become vulnerable, and it allows other people to open themselves and become vulnerable. And when they do that, they start to impose themselves onto your story. So when we tell stories about love and heartache and heartbreak, then it allows other people to open up their hearts and remember and experience their love and their heartache and their heartbreak or their romance or whatever it is. When we tell stories of rags to riches and financial defeat and struggle, then people impose themselves on that story, and they set their own experiences on top of yours, and they relive it together. And in doing so, they find that you fulfill this emotional need inside of them to feel unique. They saw that you were able to go through this and survive, and it made you somebody more special, a little bit more courageous, a little bit more tender, a little bit more insightful, a little bit more wise, a little bit more whatever it was. And so they say, oh, if Joshua did that, then I want to be like that. You know, and so you can tell stories in your copy. Now, here's an amazing thing. One of the things that I love doing is I love interviewing founders of companies. And the reason is because I like to get their story. I mean, their real story. I mean, like really what happened, and then tell that to their audience. And a lot of times these founders, these owners, these business people, you know, number one, they don't know how to tell their story. Number two, they're nervous about doing it. But when you're doing it for them, they seem to be okay with it. And in doing that, you create this amazing connectivity tissue with their audiences for the reasons we've stated, okay? So telling very personal, very intimate stories is a great way to develop rapport. The last one, heroes. Now, here's what I mean by heroes. Think about for a moment, why is it that the Harry Potter series is so crazy popular? Why is that? Well, there's a lot of great reasons, you know. One is it's a story very, very well told, but maybe below that, underneath that, is that it's an orphan underdog kind of a story, right? Harry's an orphan. And all of us sort of have this orphan child. We've all been hurt in relationships, and we all want to rise above that. We all, again, that feeling of wanting to be loved, wanting to be important, and wanting to be unique. It's the most universal set of feelings that all of us have. And we want to do something. It's why we love superheroes. It's why we love the Harry Potters of the world. It's why we love going on journeys with the Hobbit through, you know, Middle Earth and, you know, doing all these things. It's this thing that appeals to us. The underdog who becomes the hero, the hero's journey, all of those kind of things. But the most important part about this is it has to be a relatable hero. That's why the underdog, orphan, cast out, cast aside hero is the best hero, the unlikely hero, because it allows you and your reader to step into this role. You can relate to them. Like all of us can feel like we're either as good as or slightly better than a bumbling hobbit, right? And then we start on that journey with him, and it's if he could do it and become the hero, then we can too. And so we create connection and we create connectivity. And so you tell these stories of heroes and you build out a hero, and you do it in such a way that that the reader can impose themselves on that. Similar to the personal stories, but the personal stories don't necessarily have to have a hero's journey involved, but you can do a story with hero action involved in it. Okay? So these things that you do, they allow you to invoke imagination as you're telling the hero's journey, as you're walking through the personal stories, as you're using their language and talking about similar emotional triggers, etc. It invokes the imagination, and they see it in their mind, they feel it in their heart, and they experience it in real time. And that allows them to connect with you and to create rapport. So when it comes time for you to make the request and to ask for them to comply with that request, then they're predisposed to do it. And they'll be excited to do it. They'll want to do it. It's like what's that in My Fair Lady where the guy says, I'm wanting to do it. I'm willing to do it. I'm waiting to do it. Like, you know, he's excited about doing this. And so what you see here is you want to get rapport so you can create compliance. Okay. And these are some ways that you can do that we've talked about. All right. So my suggestion for you is to choose one of these things. So think about a writing assignment that you have, whether it's to build out your own information packet, your own website content, your own blog, or that for a client or whatever. Think about these five things. Pick one of these techniques and then put it to use, right? So tell a story. Think about the audience you're talking to and really dive into their language, not just their words, but their language. Intonate stuff, break things up, charge it up with underlines and bolds and make it come alive in the mind of the reader. Tell things that are deeply personal. I mean, pick one of these things and implement it and see if your readers don't feel so much more connected to you through that experience. I think you'll find that it makes an amazing, huge difference. Okay, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you later.